Autobiographical movies are weird things in a way. The more autobiographical they are, the weirder they can get. Think about it a little bit. You go into a studio and say, "Hi guys, give me a couple of wheelbarrows full of money and I'll make a movie about me." If you don't get laughed out of the business, then they give you a shit ton of money and then you have a few paths you can take. You can go the Richard Linklater dazed and confused route and make it about your formative years and keep a tight rein on things by focusing on one short period of time. In Linklater's case, a single night, and make a good film that's still well regarded after 22 years. Or you can go the Anthony Newley cynic route and totally fuck it up. Can Hieronymus Merkin ever forget Mercy Hump and find true happiness is best described as being as self-indulgent as a burp. It's full of false showbiz modesty, ludicrous character names like Good Time Eddie Filth and Mercy Hump. It breaks the fourth wall for no good reason and it contributed to Newley's divorce from Joan Collins. The lesson from this is never ever cast your wife in a movie and then name her character Polyester Poontang. But autobiographical movies can also be brilliant, and two of the brilliant ones are what I'm talking about this week. I'm going to bite off more than I can chew, to be honest. And look at Federico Fellini's 1963 movie Otto e Mezzo, 8.5, starring Marcello Mastroianni, Claudia Cardinale and Anouk Aimée. From there we move forward to 1979 for Bob Fosse's musical autobiopic All That Jazz, starring Roy Scheider, Leland Palmer, Jessica Lange and Anne Reinking. Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 155. Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it. Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 155. It's Terry here, and to quote Marilyn Monroe,
having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave.
Yep, it is hot, it is humid here, and I am waiting for the temperature to lower just that little bit. The man cave is quite warm at the moment. I've got the air conditioning going, but I haven't got it going very high because it interferes with the sound of the recording. And so it's getting a little sweat boxy in here. I've got deodorant, so it's not going to end up smelling like a lion cage. But that's how it is at the moment. I'm looking out the window at storm clouds on the horizon, great big thunderheads rising above the western plains of Melbourne. I believe the people in the Northern Hemisphere are having a different experience of life at the moment, something to do with their continent being attached to one of the polar caps of the planet, which is never a good idea. I could have told you that before you did it, but everybody stay warm while I stay cool here. And this time around, I've bitten off more than I can chew. Well, hopefully not more than I can chew, but I've got a mouthful. In doing Fellini's Otto e Mezzo, 8.5. See, I practice that. Which is the big follow-up film he did after La Dolce Vita, which I've done on a previous podcast, and I've also done for ABC Radio. So it's going to be a big ask to do 8.5 because it's just a movie of such complexity, and it's a kind of groundbreaking film, and I want to get it right, and I've been researching using a primary source, just to use a term, I. Fellini, which is Fellini's kind of biography, authorized biography by Charlotte Chandler, where she interviewed him and recorded him and transcribed him into English. So I've got primary sources for this stuff. And it's a really interesting film. Sal watched it with me, and she wasn't particularly impressed, but it's one of those films that you've got to watch with a great intensity to get the whole lot out of, and she was wandering in and out of the room and obviously didn't get the full nuance of it. But I'm doing that, and I'm also doing a little more accessible autobiographical film in All That Jazz, Bob Fosse's 1979 movie starring Roy Scheider and Jessica Lange. So that one, I think I'm going to be in a little more of a comfort zone doing it. But first off, we're going to be doing Otto e Mezzo. But first, I'm going to do the usual thing, which is what I've been watching. Now, what I've been watching, there hasn't been a hell of a lot since the last time I podcasted. But I'm going to give it a go and kind of go into it. There have been maybe two things I want to mention, but not too much else apart from that. I've really been taking a slug. I've actually weaned myself off the Xbox for now. I'm not playing that at all because I found that it does interfere way too much with my movie viewing and my television viewing and all that kind of stuff. And I really didn't want to go there. I kind of missed watching more films, if you know what I mean. So the Xbox is still sitting in the side of the man cave where it is with its nice monitor, but I'm avoiding it for now. I may go back to it later if I get fed up with watching movies, which I hope I never do, but it's in hiatus for this time. So there are only really a couple of things I want to mention that I watched, and they were both for ABC Local Radio Northern Territory. Now the second one I haven't spoken to Liz Travaskis about for the ABC Northern Territory Thursday night conversation about movies. But I want to say some things about it that I probably can't say on the radio. So the first movie I did last Thursday for ABC Radio was all about I decided to do that for the radio. I've done it for the podcast before, but I wanted to share it with Liz, and we both enjoyed All About Eve a lot. We loved the bitchiness of Addison DeWitt, played by George Sanders. We loved the way there's a lot of things the movie says about women aging in the entertainment industry that are still very valid. And so there was a lot there. And basically, even though most of the primary characters are females and the men are much more supporting, with the exception, of course, of Addison DeWitt, we kind of liked the film a lot, and it was one that was highly recommended by both of us. Now, the other thing I'm going to talk about is Revenge of the Nerds. We decided we're going to do a palate cleanser for next time, and so I've just finished watching Revenge of the Nerds, and it's not the same movie. Well, my head's not in the same place as when I first saw it in 1984, and I'll tell you why. And this may get a mention on radio. I don't know yet. I'm sure Liz will pick up on it. But the nerds break as many laws and would probably in 2015 get a lot more jail time than the jocks did. And I'll tell you why. First off, they put spy cameras in a girl's dormitory and take pictures of them undressed. That's going to get you maybe 10 years, easily 10 years, and probably a record as a sex offender. And the other thing too is that Lewis, one of the nerds, pretends to be one of the good-looking girl's boyfriends and sleeps with her before revealing who he actually is. That's going to get you another 10 years easily. From a sexual point of view, the nerds are sex offenders, whereas the jocks are just basically brutal assailants and home invasion guys, and they wreck private property and do other things and do physical assault on people. But sex offenders are actually the nerds, which makes it a really different film than it was 30 years ago when it came out. There were three sequels to it, but that's probably why they're not doing a remake of Revenge of the Nerds, because looking back at the first one, yeah, those guys are going to end up in jail and then have to go around to all their neighbours when they get out and tell them what they did. So I found that really interesting that our social views have changed so much in the 30 years that what was first thought to be a movie about the liberation of the ordinary guy has become something totally different in a lot of ways with the passage of time and with our enlightenment about sexual politics, which I found a strange thing. I wasn't expecting it because I'd forgotten the details of the movie, to be honest with you. I hadn't seen it since about 1990 on VHS. But yeah, Revenge of the nerds are sex offenders, which makes it a really strange and weird film that we're going to be reviewing. So yeah, that one's going to be a bit of fun, you know, in a dark and horrible way, I suppose. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to be getting into 8.5, Fellini's movie from 1963, starring Marcello Mastroianni, Sandra Milo, Anouk Aimi, and Claudia Cardinale. Thank you. Otto e Mezzo, also known as 8 and a Half, is a 1963 movie directed by Federico Fellini. It's the feature film he did after doing La Dolce Vita, which was an enormous success. La Dolce Vita came out in 1960. Fellini made part of an anthology film called Boccaccio 70 in about 1962. But 8 and a Half was his next feature film. Because he'd done a part of a film, he considered it his 8 and a Half movie, because he'd done 7 and a Half films before it, which is a conceit. But yeah, I can't think of a better name for the movie myself. So the story is fairly simple, but the delivery of it is very complex. I'll read from IMDb, which for a change has a nice little praise of the movie, which gives you the bare bones of it. Troubled Italian filmmaker Guido Anselmi, played by Marcello Mastroianni, struggles with creative stasis as he attempts to get a new movie off the ground. Overwhelmed by his work and personal life, the director retreats into his thoughts, which often focus on his loves both past and present, and frequently wander into fantastical territory. As he tries to sort out his many entanglements, romantic and otherwise, Anselmi finds his production becoming more and more autobiographical. The movie did win 2 Oscars, the first one for Best Costume Design Black and White for Piero Gherardi's costumes, and for Best Foreign Language Film. And it was nominated for a couple of other Oscars, including Best Director for Fellini, Best Writing Story and Screenplay, written directly for the screen. The screenplay was written by Fellini, Ennio Fliani, Tullio Pinelli, and Brunello Rondi. And I've fucked up those names, I know. It was nominated for BAFTA awards and a whole bunch of other things as well. But, and the interesting thing is that it is intensely autobiographical to a ridiculous extent. Marcello Mastroianni, 3 years after La Dolce Vita, is playing a much older guy. He's 43. Guido says in the movie. And he dresses like Fellini. He's got a cape on. He's got a very Fellini hat. He's got Fellini's mannerisms, while still having that kind of Mastroianni charm about him. He's balancing off, Guido's balancing his wife, played by Anouk Aimée, who looks stunning in this movie. Very much my type of woman, so I'm stunned by how lovely she looks. She only comes into the second half of the film, but my eyes are not off her on the screen when she's on there. And his wife is intelligent and chic and stylish and, you know, kind of everything that a man should want in a wife. But he also has a mistress who is very much the opposite. She's kind of not too bright. She's earthy and buxom, and he finds her sexually intensely attractive. For reasons we later find out in a flashback he has to his childhood, he's drawn to tawdry and slightly grotesque women. And there is a reason. There is a flashback in the film where, as a boy, he and his friends, who are in a very strict Catholic school, go down to the beach and to an old, it looks like an old pillbox or something like that, where a large, gross prostitute will dance for them if they give her some money. And he gets caught for that, young Guido, and gets intensely punished by the priests who run the school. Way out of proportion to anything he's done wrong. And this again got Fellini into a lot of trouble at the time, because the Catholic Church was very pissed off with him about it, because there are some scenes with a Catholic cardinal which aren't kind of rude, but they're subtly showing the dogma of the time in the Catholic Church, and you know, it hasn't got entirely better since then. And the fact that they film the scenes with the cardinal in a steam room at a spa makes it very, very interesting for me. Hell seems to be Catholic cardinals, according to Fellini's philosophy, which is quite fun. The movie starts with a really nice little dream sequence where Guido's in a car stuck in a traffic jam, and there are people all around him doing various things. There's a couple necking, and people are staring at him a lot, and he can't get out of the car, and the car starts filling up with petrol fumes. And eventually he flies out of the car and into the air. He's about to fly up into heaven, but there's a rope tied around his leg, and his friends are dragging back to earth. And then he wakes up. And that, of course, This is the first of the dream sequences right at the very start of the film. Guido's in the spa. He's recovering from some kind of breakdown, perhaps. And he was also getting ready to film his movie in that in around there, too. And you get the usual... The thing is that this is the thing I found out about Fellini that I found most interesting while researching this film. Fellini always has a parade in his movies. And this one's got several parades. They're not formal parades necessarily, but Fellini loved circuses as a child, which is one of the reasons why, I suppose, that Nino Rota's music for this and other Fellini films, even La Dolce Vita, there's a kind of circus feel to the music, which is a deliberate choice made. And there are a bunch of parades, and the first one is the people at the spa where Guido is going to be making his movies. There are grotesque ladies in frilly white dresses. There are grotesque old men. It's just a really interesting, if you like faces in a movie, this is a really interesting movie because there are a whole bunch of different kinds of faces, from the stunningly beautiful being Anouk Aimée and Claudia Cardinale, amongst others, to some really people who, for whom time has taken them down a back alley and beat the shit out of them. So, and Guido's there with his producer, Gocco Pace, who basically acts like a critic within the movie and criticizes the things he says and the things he's planning. So it's almost like Fellini was anticipating the critics of the movie by putting a producer who is criticizing the film from within the film, which makes it really fun. And one of the things that Fellini did, which was very important to him in this movie, was he had a piece of brown tape stuck over the lens of the camera. And the tape said, "Don't forget this is a comedy," or words to that effect. So, and once you realize, yes, it is a comedy, you can kind of relax a little more into the film. And as I said, the film does bear intense watching. You won't get the most out of it unless you watch it intensely. There are a number of classic sequences in the film as well. There's a fantasy sequence with every woman that Guido had a relationship with or wanted to have a relationship with, all live in one big house together, and at first they're kind of fawning over him, bathing him and looking after him and coddling him, and then they throw a revolution against him and he tries to hold them off with a whip, but that doesn't really work. And it's really great because at first you go, okay, well, Guido's having a male fantasy about all the women he's ever loved and lusted after or had a relationship with, living with them all in a house where none of them are arguing with each other, and as they get older, he can put them up into the attic, and all this kind of male fantasy stuff. But then Fellini subverts it by having the women throw a revolution against that. And they turn against Guido, which, of course, is one of those things that happens in dreams. Sometimes you can be having a good dream, and then it slips into a nightmare. And that's what happens in this one. And it's more than anything, it's mocking both Fellini and the character Guido's relationships with women and the immaturity of them. There is a scene early in the movie where he's thinking back on his childhood, where all the kids, for therapeutic reasons, are bathing in wine. And then they have warm bath sheets wrapped around them, and they're tucked into warm beds, and they have a little get together amongst the kids and things like that. And it's one of the fond memories Guido has of his childhood. It's a lovely little scene and a lovely conceit. And it's triggered by unusual things. All of the dream sequences and the fantasy sequences are triggered by unusual things. The scenes where Guido as a child meets the prostitute who dances for the children is triggered by a woman he sees walking down a hill when he's talking to a Catholic priest at the spa. And the scene where he remembers a childhood at the farm is triggered by a mind-reading act when they're all out to dinner, all the people who are about to make this movie are out to dinner. And there's a supernaturally good mind-reading act where the man goes around and asks questions of people, and a very elderly lady with a blackboard answers the questions. And they're not, it's not one of those things like in Nightmare Alley where it's actually a word substitution thing. This woman is ostensibly a genuine telepath. And there are some nonsense syllables that she perceives that Guido is saying. And it turns out that the nonsense syllables relate to a childhood game he played while he was on the farm. So the flashbacks are incredibly imaginatively set up, and they do give you insight into the character. Now, the other thing I found really interesting in this film, and there was a lot of fun for me being the geek that I am, is the movie that Guido just can't get started is a science fiction epic. And in fact, they're building an enormous scaffolding for the rocket ship for the movie on a beach, and they're going to use something a bit like a hanging mat to get the rocket ship there. And they do show you the rocket and they paint it onto a piece of glass that they're going to use against the scaffolding to make the rocket ship there. And I thought, I would love to see a science fiction movie that Guido or Fellini directed, but that wasn't on the cards and it never happened. But the science fiction geek in me kind of embraced that. And this movie really does make you think a hell of a lot about the movie making process. Everybody wants something from the director, and the director has nothing to give because he doesn't know what the story's going to be and he doesn't know what the movie's going to be, so he evades and charms and kind of dodges his way through the maze of insecure actors and actresses and producers who are worried about the budget and other people who are worried they're getting too old to do their jobs, and some people who want to force their agents who want to force the actresses into bigger parts in the movie. There are all those kind of things that are going on. But essentially, Guido is thinking about himself and thinking about how he's going to get through this, and he doesn't think he can make the movie. And in fact, he never does make the movie. And the interesting thing I found in the movie as well is the movie within a movie, the movie that Guido is supposed to be making, doesn't have a leading man. Guido's at the center of the picture because he can't make the movie. There is no actor waiting on the sidelines to be the leading man of the film. There are actresses around and there are all of the hangers-on and the technical people, but there is no leading man for this movie, because I think that would have distracted us from the story of which Guido is the centre. But again, the black and white photography in this film is fantastic. The sets, for instance, the spa and the steam rooms and the train station is particularly beautiful in this movie. A lot of it was filmed on location, but some of it was filmed at Cinecittà as well. But I've seen this movie for the first time. Today is the day I saw this movie for the first time, so I was still trying to absorb it all in order to regurgitate it into your mouth like a baby bird. But this is one of those movies that I'm going to leave it for 6 months or so, and then I'm going to revisit it. And I'm sure I'll get more out of it the more times I've seen it. People have already said that they did, and I'm just at the start of that journey. And it's like La Dolce Vita. About a year's time, I'm going to watch La Dolce Vita again, even though it is 2.5 hours, and there are other movies I could be watching. But there are a lot of details and nuances and textures that you don't get the first time you watch a movie like this. And, of course, you've got the extra alienating thing of it being in a foreign language. So you've got the barrier of subtitles to overcome as well. But there are a lot of things about this movie that already I love. I love the way, at the start, Marcello Mastroianni plays with his sunglasses when he looks over his sunglasses at people. That's incredibly cool for some reason. I like the women are fleshed-out characters in the movie, particularly the wife played by Anouk Aimée, and her name is, and I've got to give people their names, her name's Louisa. The mistress, Carla, played by Sandra Milo, is interesting as well. Barbara Steele's in the movie, playing Gloria, an actress, who's also the girlfriend of one of Guido's friends, a guy called, and I have trouble with his name, Mezzabotta. You got, of course, Guido Alberti playing Pace, the producer, who is acting as that internal critic in the movie. Madeleine Lebeau, a French actress playing a French actress, is a stretch. Madeleine Lebeau is an interesting actor as well. She was married to Marcel Dalio, and both of them were in Casablanca. She played Yvonne, who was Rick's girlfriend, in Casablanca. And Marcel Dalio played the croupier in the movie as well. They were married at the time. And the interesting thing is Madeleine Lebeau is the last remaining actor from Casablanca who had a speaking role, who is still alive. She's something like 93 at the moment. But she's hanging in there and still alive. Edra Gale, who plays La Saragina, the prostitute that Guido and his friends see when he's a child, is played by an American female actor called Edra Gale, who was also a singer and who went on to have a career in Hollywood doing minor roles. She was quite a large lady, so she kind of got relegated to those fat lady roles in that sense. But and Rosetta Falk's in it, so another actress who has a really interesting look. The thing I remember her for most of all is she played Mrs. Fothergill in the movie version, 1966 movie version of Modesty Blaze. And she's got very sharp features and beautiful eyes. And I really like her in a number of movies. She was also in a really bad movie starring Kim Novak and Peter Finch called The Legend of Lila Clare, directed by Robert Aldrich. I'm glad I didn't see this movie before now for a number of reasons. First off, when I was young and callow, I probably wouldn't have appreciated it. I wouldn't have got all the nuances. I wouldn't have understood the problems of middle-aged guys as well as I do now for some obscure reason. And having seen other films, like Rossellini's Viaggio in Italia, with George Sanders and Ingrid Bergman in it, and having seen La Dolce Vita and a few other of those classic Italian films, I think I was about ready for 8.5. And I'm going to have to really do more Fellini now, because I love concentrating on films. And you know, most of the time you'd let a movie just wash over you. There's a lot of films that we watch just for entertainment and to fill the time, and because they give us a little squee. But then there are movies like this you really got to dive down to the bottom of and pry open a shell to get the pearl out of. And I love the fact that I can discover this movie. And I paid criminally little for the Blu-ray of it as well. I think it was Umbrella Entertainment who did it. And they were selling off Blu-rays of La Dolce Vita and also of Otto e Mezzo for $10 each. And they've got some extras in them. I mean, they're not Criterion editions, but they're good editions. The prints are fantastically good. The subtitles were done by SBS here in Australia, and they are incredibly accurate subtitles as well, among the best you'll get. And, and the movie does take you along. You wonder where it's going. It never goes anywhere you're predictable at all. The characters wander in and wander out, but in the centre of it still is the kind of bemused and slightly passive figure of Guido. And that's something Roger Ebert said about Marcello Mastroianni, is that he's one of the most passive leading men in movie history. Things happen around and to him more than him acting on things. The only exception of that might be The Tenth Victim, where he goes shooting around New York trying to kill Ursula Andress, or she's trying to kill him. But apart from that, he's a very kind of languid and passive and very charismatic leading man. There'd be a lot worse fates in the world to look like Marcello Mastroianni, I can tell you. But I'm not sure what else to say about the film. I want people to find it and reveal and have the things revealed to them rather than me telling you about them. It's a solid piece of movie making. It's probably my best discovery this year so far. And I am going to revisit it. I think that there will be nuances and things that I've missed from it. I was very, very careful before I watched it not to do any research on it. I wanted to come at it fresh and to discover things. The only thing I read was that little IMDb précis that I mentioned earlier on. Beyond that, I did all the research after watching the film this afternoon. And I'm sure I'm missing nuances to it. I'm sure I'm missing important scenes, and I'm sure I'm missing little plot points that are quite important to it. But it's a movie I did appreciate a hell of a lot, and it's one that I treasure. I think that, that's the other thing I've got to mention too. Reading I, Fellini. I'm not sure I mentioned it earlier or not. It's getting late in the day for me. Is that Fellini, when he was making Otto e Mezzo, didn't know what the movie was about. So just like his character, he really didn't have an idea what the movie was going to be, what the movie was going to be about. And to the extent that he possibly could, even though there are scriptwriters, including himself, he really didn't know what it was going to be and made it up as he went along. And nonetheless, it all does hold together incredibly well. It's like somebody threw mud on the wall and it made the Mona Lisa almost. All of the pieces fit together and all of the stuff fits together. And it's the movie it reminded me of most, and this is an odd thing, is Birdman, the recent film with Michael Keaton. First off, it is about creative people who are having trouble, but also it's got that touch of magic realism about it that Birdman has as well, and that flight, the flights of fantasy that kind of illuminate other things that are happening and make comment on the other things that are happening during the movie. So it had very much the feel of that for me. And of course there are dream sequences and fantasy sequences in the second movie I'm going to talk about today, being All That Jazz. Of course, after you make a movie like Otto Immeso, you're really not going to not influence other people. Anybody who does an autobiographical movie from about a creative person who's blocked is going to think back on this movie and be influenced by it, not necessarily copy it. I mean, I think that Anthony Newley's movie, Can Hieronymus Smoke and Ever Forget, and Mercy Hump and Find True Happiness, did ape a lot of the stuff that Fellini did in this movie. Very unsuccessfully, of course, and I probably should talk about that movie at some stage just to do a podcast about bad movies. That would definitely be one to do for it. But just to wrap up, Nino Rota's music's fantastic. The actors and the actresses in this film are fantastic. Fellini is fantastic. Black and white movies do have a charm in the hands of the right people that even colour films don't have. And I'm looking forward to seeing this movie again. I'm not going to do it for a little while. I'm going to let the first viewing digest. But I'm very lucky in the fact that it's still fairly fresh for me and that I haven't got jaded by it. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now because as you can hear, my throat is starting to rasp a little bit. And when I get back, we're going to be talking about All That Jazz starring Roy Scheider, Jessica Lange, and Ryan King, Leland Palmer, and John Lithgow.
To be on the wire is life. The rest is waiting.
That's very theatrical, Joe.
Yeah, I know.
Did you make it up?
I wish I had. You like it?
Well, it's all right.
It's showtime, folks.
Okay, let's talk about All That Jazz. Well, you can if you like, but I won't hear you, but I'll talk about All That Jazz. 1979 movie directed by Bob Fosse. Screenplay was by Bob Fosse and Robert Allen Author. And it was produced, cinematographer was Giuseppe Rotunno, who also did a couple of Fellini films. So the link between Fellini's 8.5 and All That Jazz is fairly strong. The Fellini films he did were Fellini's Casanova and Satyricon. He also was the cinematographer on The Leopard, which I've really got to do in a future podcast, and a bunch of other films. Amarcord, so he did that as well. And The Night Porter, so pretty. And also did Red Sonja and Rent-A-Cop. So yeah, here you go. You got a guy who's the cinematographer for Fellini, right? Dig it. The guy has been with Fellini. So what does he do? He does a comedy crime drama in 1988 starring Burt Reynolds and Liza Minnelli. Poor bastard. I mean, that's got me totally saddened now. Did a cinematographer with those kind of chops end up doing a kind of romantic comedy with Liza Minnelli and Burt Reynolds? For fuck's sake. Anyway, getting back on track, the movie stars Roy Scheider as Joe Gideon, director and choreographer, who has a complicated personal life and is suffering health issues and eventually has a heart attack, which is always a laugh, right? But the movie is great. It's a semi-autobiographical, directed on the life of Bob Fosse. The cast, of course, Roy Scheider playing totally against type as Joe Gideon. Roy Scheider is not the first guy you go to play a song and dance man. But he does pretty good. Even though he can't dance, they kind of work around that really well. And unless you're watching Scheider to see him not dance, you don't really notice that he doesn't particularly. You got Jessica Lange playing Angelique, who may be the Angel of Death. May not be, who knows. Leland Palmer playing Audrey Paris. Not the Leland Palmer from Twin Peaks, but Leland Palmer, the actor, playing Audrey Paris, Joe's ex-wife. And she is kind of based on Bob Fosse's ex-wife, Gwen Verdon. Anne Reinking playing Kate Jagger, and that is based on Anne Reinking herself, who had a relationship up until the year before this movie was made with Bob Fosse. Now, dig this. Anne Reinking is going for a role based on herself. She had to do an audition to play herself in a movie. Cliff Gorman playing Davis Newman. This is a kind of... He's kind of playing Dustin Hoffman in Lenny. Because the comedian that Cliff Gorman plays in the movie within a movie and all that jazz is very much like the Bob Fosse directed movie Lenny, about Lenny Bruce, with Dustin Hoffman. The interesting thing is that Lenny was originally a stage play way back in the 1960s with Cliff Gorman starring in it on Broadway. So Cliff Gorman played Lenny Bruce before Dustin Hoffman played Lenny Bruce. You've got Ben Vereen playing a smarmy TV host called O'Connor Flood. Elspeth Foldy playing Michelle, who is Joe Gideon's daughter. And a whole bunch of other people in there. Now, this movie has so much vitality. For a movie about a guy dying, it has a lot of vitality about it. And, of course, you've got to look back at the history of Bob Fosse to really appreciate that. Bob Fosse started as a hoofer and did a few movies in the early 1950s. He did things like Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. He did that fantastic dance sequence in Kiss Me, Kate as well. He did a nice little song and dance with Gwen Verdon in Damn Yankees, which he choreographed as well. Bob Fosse only directed 5 feature films. I'm going to see if I can remember what they are off the top of my head. There was Sweet Charity with Shirley MacLaine, based on the stage production he did, which was based on Knights of Cabiria, a Fellini film. So there's another link to Fellini there. He did Cabaret, for which he won a Best Director Oscar, beating out Coppola for The Godfather, no less. Of course, he did all that jazz. He did Lenny, and he did Star 80, which was about Dorothy Stratton, and wasn't a particularly successful way to end a career. Now, Bob Fosse had had a couple of heart attacks. He had health issues pretty much through his life. He stopped performing on Broadway in 1961 when it was discovered, he already knew this, but when it was discovered that he had epilepsy and had an epileptic seizure on stage. So after that, he went more into direction and choreography and things like that and stayed away from front of house. And, of course, he was immensely successful in that. He did Pippin, he did Sweet Charity on Broadway, he did Redhead with Gwen Verdon, he did The New Girl in Town, which was based on a really sad old play. But basically, Fosse revolutionized dance in the commercial theater. He also had a couple of heart attacks. So yes, like Joe Gideon in All That Jazz, he smoked, he took Dexedrine to stay awake. He drank a bit and basically totally fucked his health and ended up dying at the age of 60, having had immense fame and fortune during his life and affairs with many women. He wasn't a particularly faithful person in real life, and that, of course, comes across in All That Jazz. And I think even though it is set up very musically, there are any number of musical numbers in there, and there are re-engineered pop songs which are used to tell a slightly different story, a trait which he has in common with people like David Lynch, and in a much watered-down and puerile way, people like Baz Luhrmann. But I think that in this movie, Fosse uses it really, really well. And I think, arguably, I'd say it was Roy Scheider's best acting role. He's acting totally against type, but he brings a charm and a wit and a dedication and a passion that Joe Gideon has to the movie. The movie starts with a Broadway cattle call for dancers with the music on Broadway by George Benson playing underneath it. And it's a fantastic montage of work. The way it was filmed was that Roy Scheider had an earpiece in when he was down on stage, filtering out the dancers until they got down to the dancers that they needed for the stage production within the movie. And he had an earpiece in, and Bob Fosse was telling him what to do down on stage. So basically, Roy Scheider filtered out everybody they didn't need for the movie as dancers by listening to Bob Fosse and Bob Fosse literally whispering in his ear during that. It was an incredibly hard little piece to film, even though it's brilliantly edited and put together, and it does work incredibly well. The reason it was so hard is that the whole sequence, which has a lot of cuts and tells a lot of story and tells who this guy is to a great extent without words, though towards the end when he's talking to the last few dancers, you do get a sense of the charm. It was filmed in the Palace Theatre on 1564 Broadway in Manhattan, and they did it in 2 days. They only had the theatre for 2 days, and so that whole on-Broadway sequence at the start was totally done, multiple camera setups in 2 days, which is pretty impressive stuff. Every time I see that bit, it draws you into the movie and draws you into that on-stage world, and really does have a great energy to it, which carries you through the movie. Now, the other actors in the film are really cool. I like Anne Reinking particularly. I find her very attractive and also very good and poignant as Kate, the current girlfriend of Joe Gideon. Leland Palmer as Audrey is also really good. Both of them, Anne Reinking is now kind of a legend on Broadway, but Leland Palmer kind of quit the business not too long after and moved on from it. But both of them are... There is that Fellini aspect to this as well, where the women are the most interesting characters in some way, though. Scheider as Joe is quite charismatic. It's interesting watching the women react to him, and both professionally and personally, because both of them are involved with him on a professional basis. And that kind of makes it interesting. And one of the other bits that I really like in the film too, which is strong and relates back to a previous work that Bob Fosse did, is the erotica sequence, where they've got a bland kind of poppy song about flying in airplanes with a lot of double entendres that the writer of it, a flamboyantly gay character called Paul, played by Anthony Holland, doesn't really see in it. And then they show the evolution of it as Joe is trying to make this song work as a dance number in the play they're doing. And after having an argument and a discussion with his ex-wife, Audrey, rethinks it all and reinvents it all as a much more raunchy and confronting piece of work, which again has some parallels to Fellini. There's a couple of Fellini-esque touches in the erotica sequence, the primary dancer in that being Sandahl Bergman, who went up against Arnold Schwarzenegger in one of the Conan movies as well. Really good dancer and a very attractive woman. That sequence is intensely erotic in a lot of ways without showing too much flesh. It's just beautifully buff men and women who are dancers moving in various configurations and just blowing me away every time I watch it. The erotica sequence I do like a lot, not just for the erotic part of it, but it shows something that Fosse did at various times in his career on stage, which is taking something that wasn't really working and reinventing it and intensifying it and making it something totally different. The parallel with the career of Bob Fosse in the erotica sequence in his real on-stage career was the Big Spender sequence in Sweet Charity, which was done, which would have been kind of a normal 1960s kind of Broadway play kind of thing. But Fosse intensified the boredom of the dance girls in the... It's set in a dance hall, which ostensibly is a dance hall, but basically they're really hookers for hire. And the boredom that they have for the guys for whom they were paid to dance with, which I've explained really badly. But what Fosse did was intensified that and kind of made it a much more deep and serious and realistic piece than it would otherwise have been. I mean, there are any number of people who stood up on a stage and belted out Big Spender, including Shirley Bassey, amongst others, but to see it in the original context of the stage play or the movie as Sweet Charity makes it a totally different experience and a much darker one. And that's one of the things that Fosse could do. I mean, look what he did in Cabaret with Tomorrow Belongs to Me and a few of the other things that were on stage in the nightclub in Berlin. The way he kind of twisted pop songs into a darker way. And he does this as well in All That Jazz. I mean, by turning the Everly Brothers' Bye Bye Love into something totally different. He does it a number of times during the movie. I've liked this movie since I first saw it in 1979. In fact, I've got the soundtrack for it on vinyl, which I bought at the time, and which I'm not playing again because I don't want to ruin the vinyl, as you do after a while with records that you treasure. Some really great music on there. There's some pop songs, there's some instrumental pieces as well, but I do like the soundtrack to this, and I do like the fact that somebody like Roy Scheider did step out of his comfort zone big time to make this movie. Now, there were a number of other actors who were going up for the role of Joe Gideon. I'm just trying to bring up the IMDb on this, because there were some surprising choices that they wanted to have to play Joe Gideon in this movie, and who eventually, for whatever reason, didn't do it. I'm just grabbing that now. It won't be a moment. Riveting podcasting sounds of me going, and other things. Richard Dreyfuss was originally cast but left the production during the rehearsal stage. So Dreyfuss was big at the time. I don't know whether it was to do with the self-medicating that he was doing at the time or not. But let me see, there were a number of others. Jack Lemmon passed on the role because he thought he was too old for it as well. And by the way, I'm sure you can hear the crickets outside my window now. It's just rained pretty heavily and the crickets are out and about doing what they do. But other actors who were considered for the role and who went for it were Alan Bates, but he was considered too British for the role. Let me see, Paul Newman turned down the role of Joe Gideon. Alan Alda and Gene Hackman were considered for the role, and John Voight. So it was one of those ones where they did search around a lot to try to find somebody who could play this. But I think they did well with Roy Scheider. I mean, Roy Scheider nailed it. He really did, with the little kind of goatee and the cigarette in the corner of his mouth and the black tight clothing he wears and the dance slippers. And yeah, he just looks right for it, too. It's pretty clear that he was in great shape at the time and really worked hard at the role and showed us a side to his skills that we hadn't seen before, even though, of course, everyone remembers him as Martin Brody in Jaws. This movie brings something totally different to the game and does it really well. I really liked some of the minor characters as well. People like Jonesy, who's one of the producers of the show, played by William Massena, who had worked with Bob Fosse on stage in the 1950s as well. So he brought back a whole bunch of actors in the smaller roles with whom he'd worked on Broadway and got them a gig. Some of them were less successful than others in their careers, of course, but he got them a gig doing various bits and pieces for him in this movie, and I kind of like that as well. People that you haven't seen before, they're fresh faces, even though they're experienced stage actors, and some of them were in their 50s and 60s. They were faces that we hadn't seen before on screen particularly. And putting them in there with the more experienced and more familiar people was a good move. And, of course, this is something that Fellini did as well. He'd get the stars that he had, but he'd also get a number of smaller actors who you see again and again in Fellini movies, who were kind of, you know, jobbing Italian character actors. So there are a lot of parallels between this and 8.5, and not in a bad way either. I mean, they do cross over a little bit, and there's a kind of template similarity to the two movies in the sense that you've got a director who's struggling to get through a project. You've got him with a number of personal hassles and professional hassles. And, of course, because of Bob Fosse's own history, health hassles. And he talks about heart attacks and dying, which, of course,
Bob Fosse did about 10 or 12, actually 9 years after he made all that jazz, he stepped on the rainbow. 8 and 9 years. So, you know, he knew he was on his way out, kind of. But he kind of confronted that too, and he went through the Elizabeth Kubler-Ross thing about the stages of knowing you're going to die and all that kind of thing. And you do see Joe Gideon go through those stages and end up singing an old song with a janitor as he's kind of come to accept his own mortality, which is a nice way of doing it. I really like the way they handle his denial, his bargaining, and eventually his acceptance of his own mortality, and the fact that they turn it into a great big kind of, not Broadway, but it's almost like a television special with a big rows of audience around there with all the people in his life sitting in there as he and the doctors and his girlfriend and his ex-wife and his daughter basically perform a stage show around him while he's dying on his bed, including himself. Which is hard to explain, but you know what I mean when you see the movie. But this film is strong. I really like it. I think that while it is following the same template as Fellini's 8 and a half, does it about somebody else's life, somebody who's, a creative genius. You don't win an Oscar and beat Francis Ford Coppola to an Oscar without being a genius. You don't get more Tony Awards than anybody up to the time he died for not being some kind of a genius, and Bob Fosse definitely was that. My favourite Bob Fosse role in a movie, and it's a very minor one, you might want to look it up on YouTube, is him singing Snake in the Grass for a very small, obscure movie based on The Little Prince, called The Little Prince, which starred Richard Kiley and Gene Wilder and a bunch of other people. And he basically plays Satan as a snake. And it's just a little soft shoe shuffle kind of role, but it is a lovely bit. In fact, I may play the audio from that after I finish this podcast. I'll post it near the end because I really like him doing Snake in the Grass. But you really should see the YouTube video of it to fully appreciate it. But I'm going to wrap it up for all that jazz. The music's great. The acting's great. The dancing is superb. You got Roy Scheider stepping out of his comfort zone. You've got John Lithgow playing a theatre director who is about to be brought in as Joe gets ill to complete the project. And there's a beautifully subtle way that Fosse has of saying that this guy's a lesser talent when he's discussing the project with Jonesy as he's arranging the lighting for his own project. You get the sense that he's definitely a guy who kind of goes through the motions of what he does rather than having a passion for it, and it's portrayed very subtly in that. But anyway, both of these movies are great ones to be seen. I mean, doing this kind of autobiographical film can be seen as self-indulgent if you don't do it right, but I think that both Fellini and Bob Fosse did it right in the sense that they were willing to be, to varying degrees, honest about their own lives when they're writing these kind of autobiographical films. And they're not willing to kind of whitewash themselves the way perhaps a more contemporary person might do. So it doesn't have that kind of, you know, oh, poor me kind of thing about it. It's got the honesty about it. And the fact that maybe, you know, some of these things are things that they need to have genius, to have those kind of ability to exclude external stuff. And to focus on the project above all else, and even if there is a cost to their personal lives. But anyway, I'm going to wrap it up there. I'm going to play Bob Fosse singing Snake in the Grass. I've got a little bit of feedback for us, but I'm going to save it till next time. So sorry about that, Morris. It's definitely going to be in the next Paleo Cinema. And I'm going to, of course, leave people with the credits for all of the supporters and subscribers to the podcast who have put their hands in their pockets and can be seen to be supporting podcasting for as little as $1 a week. But anyway, in the meantime, up north, stay warm. Down here, stay cool. Look after yourselves. Look after the people around you. I wish you all the best. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleo Cinema. And I'll be back next week with another Martian Drive-In podcast. So take care of yourselves, and I'll see you soon.
You seem like a smart, sensible sort. Why did you swing down to this sorry, sleazy swamp?
I'm trying to learn something.
I see. Well, sir, this speck in space is a scholastic sewer. All that you can learn here is sorrow. Sorrow. If I were you, I'd scram.
I can't. My flock of birds have flown away.
So?
They brought me here.
I see. Listen, you are so lucky that you met me.
Why am I lucky?
Well, you see, if someday, any day, you want to see your own small, sparkling star again, I may have a solution. You see, I have this special, sting. It's almost painless, and it can send you scooting out of this sad slum and sailing into the sweet, sunny, splendiferous sky.
Really?
If you would like to cure the fever called life, get some relief from all the struggle and strife, the grandest medicine that I can propose is under your nose, a snake in the grass. If you would like a spot where life never goes, where you can leave your body home in your clothes, the finest travel agent you'll ever meet is right at your feet, a snake in the grass. One sting, and you can say goodbye to all of your friends. One sting, and you'll be singing as your spirit ascends. All's well that ends. So any day or night, wherever you are, if you would like to take a trip to a star, the quickest transportation yet known to man is none other than a snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. If you would like to leave that inhuman race and take up residence out yonder in space, when you are ready to go traveling on, sit right down upon a snake in the grass. One sting is quite enough to make you happy and free. One sting, and you'll discover how relaxed you can be posthumously. And while you're wandering through the heavenly blue, if you should see the Lord come strolling in view, go up and say you bring him best wishes from his fallen old chum, a snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. One sting. It's almost painless. A snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. A snake in the grass. I'll be waiting.
Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the Scientific Advisor, Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Armin, the Key Grip,
Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the musical director, Gary, the prop master, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the script doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people. And if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.